Stu Does America.
Follow the show on YouTube, please. YouTube.com/Stu Does America. Hit the bell for notifications. Seems like most people are fans of Donald Trump's Israeli Hamas ceasefire deal so far, which is shocking, I know. There's people actually saying good things about it. We'll look at the polling on that. The Toronto Blue Jays, America's team, are the new American League champions. We'll talk about that momentous victory. But we start by doing the Obamacare time bomb. Actually, before I get into Obamacare, I want to start with something not unrelated, but related. Okay. Trump administration agreeing to deliver more student loan forgiveness. What a headline that one is. The outcome is the result of an agreement reached on Friday between the U.S. Department of Education and the American Federation of Teachers, Teachers Union. And in the agreement, the Trump administration said it will begin again process student loan forgiveness for eligible borrowers in two income-driven repayment plans, the original income contingent repayment plan and the pay-as-you-earn plan, as long as those programs remain in effect. In the agreement with the AFT, the Trump administration also clarified that borrowers who become eligible for student loan forgiveness in 2025 won't owe federal taxes on the relief, a law that provides tax-free treatment on the federal level for canceled education debt that expires at the end of this year. So basically what we're looking at is the Trump administration and teachers unions got together and they said, hey, how can we work on this student loan forgiveness thing? Now, some of these programs are not the unconstitutional ones that that Biden was working on, although the same arguments apply here. It's important to note, like when, you know, I mean, if you borrow money, like our expectation is that you pay it back. I mean, this isn't too much to ask, but there are some programs that deal with this. And it's just an extension to this program. So eventually this is going to go away. Now, this is the part I want to focus on a little bit, because, as you know, I'm not in favor of any of the student loan relief type stuff. That's not my bag. Like that. Don't like it. It's just how I feel. OK, so you know that already. So I won't bore you with all those arguments yet again. What I will focus you on is this. President Donald Trump's big, beautiful bill will phase out ICR and PAYE pay. Those are the two programs we're talking about. As of July 1st, 2028, I want you to internalize that date for a moment and ask yourself a question. Do I really think these programs will go away on July 1st, 2028? Think for a moment of that date. What will be going on? What will people be thinking about on July 1st, 2028? We will be in the midst of a presidential election. The heat of it will be right around the time when we're having big fat parties to celebrate the nominees in various cities around the country. Do we really think these programs are going away in July of 2028? Maybe they will. Maybe they will. You can come back to me in July of 2028 and say, Stu, you are too skeptical of the government. Now, no one's ever won money betting on me being too skeptical of the government. But maybe this will be the one time. My point here is, a lot of times what you're seeing, you know, I don't know if the Trump administration thought of this. They're pretty strategic people. Maybe they did. But I guarantee you, the teachers union definitely is excited about that particular date. Why does that date matter? Well, let me go now to Obamacare. Senate Republicans head to the White House in a show of unity as he shutdown enters his fourth week. By the way, a picture there, Chip Roy, when we're talking about the Senate, which is kind of odd. He's not in the Senate and not running for the Senate. He's running for Attorney General in Texas. He's also, by the way, I will say, arguing for to end the shutdown with a getting rid of the filibuster. I do not favor that. I love Chip. He's a great guy and really smart on this stuff. That stuff makes me super nervous. I don't want keep the filibuster around as long as we can. The government does more damage than it ever could without it. The Senate is at least a bit of a stopgap when Democrats are trying to do stuff. I don't want to get rid of any more of that. So I'm just throwing that out there. GOP White House shutdown. It's from the AP News. Senate Republicans are headed to the White House on Tuesday, not for urgent talks on how to end it, but for a display of unity with President Donald Trump as they refuse to negotiate on any Democratic demands. Senate Democrats, too, are confident in their strategy to keep voting against House-passed bills that would reopen the government until Republicans, including Trump, engaged in them on extending health care subsidies that expire at the end of the year. So it's important to note that they're going, this is an Obamacare-related issue. Doesn't mean Obamacare is going to go away. We'll get into that here in a second. But it also is not going away at all until the end of the year. So why are they so interested in shutting down the government now? Like, they could have had a deal that the Republicans presented that said, hey, you know, 7 weeks of funding and we'll get back into this. And those subsidies would all have been going on then. Why not wait? Here's Hakeem Jeffries talking, making quite possibly the dumbest argument I've ever heard about the shutdown. Like, nothing you're about to hear is accurate or true. I'm playing it more just to make fun of Hakeem Jeffries, because let's be honest about it. There are people on the left that are really stupid, like AOC, for example, or Jasmine Crockett, or what's his face? The guy in California that slept with the Chinese spy. Those people are just morons, okay? I don't think Hakeem Jeffries is a moron, but he is a giant zilch. He has no gravitas whatsoever. He does not seem to really be good at this. I don't know why they chose him. I really don't. I mean, Nancy Pelosi was not a great communicator, or certainly was terrible on policy, but she did have a way of wielding a lot of power behind the scenes. So there's an argument for her as House Speaker. I don't know what the argument is for Jeffries. He just seems to suck at all of this, but here he is sucking.
Donald Trump definitively needs to get involved. He needs to get off the sidelines, get off the golf course, and actually decide to end the shutdown that he's created,
he has
allowed to happen.
We
know that House and Senate Republicans don't do anything without getting permission from their boss,
he says this
Donald J. Trump.
Same stuff every day.
And the reason why there have been no negotiations, zero negotiations, since Republicans shut the government down, is because Donald Trump clearly wants the government shut down. He wants to inflict pain on the American people.
It's impossible for, I don't have the time to go through every one of the dumb statements there, but like, the Republicans have voted to open up the government many, many times. I think 12 now. They wanted to, and this is against what I want, by the way. To be clear, I don't want these funding levels to continue. I think it's bad. I'd rather have the government shut down. When he's saying, hey, you want the government shut down, that's what Trump wants. I want it. They don't want it at all. They keep voting over and over and over again to reopen it. And of course, when it comes to negotiations, like, they have actually offered multiple times to have debates and negotiations about these dumb issues Democrats are bringing up. However, the Democrats have voted that down every time. They want it to happen now. Why? Why do they want to keep this going on? It's interesting to know. By the way, how is everything working out? There's one theory, and I think there's some validity to this theory. And I think it's an interesting one, which is the reason why, Democrats are starting to maybe panic a little bit is because their polling isn't so great on this. Harry Enten made a point like this on CNN. Also, the latest Reuters Ipsos poll, this one closed Monday, shows 42% of Americans approve of Trump's performance in office, up two points from a survey conducted earlier this month. The president's approval rating last hit 42% in early September. Now, the argument basically, presented by Enten and others is, hey, this isn't really hurting the president like it has in previous shutdowns. So he's not that worried about ending it. And maybe that's true. I will say, Trump kind of solved Middle East peace in this process as well at this timeline. So a couple of point bump might be more of a reflection of other things going on than the reaction to the shutdown, which really hasn't had a lot of attention drawn to it. At least that's the way I perceive it. In the poll, 50% of all adults blame congressional Republicans, 43% blame Democrats, 7% skip the question. Among Republicans, 84% say Democrats, 14% on their own party. On the other side, 89% of Democrats blame the GOP, 9% blame their own party. The independents, 51% blame the GOP, 34% blame Democrats. So again, like, it kind of supports the idea that the polling situation hasn't been super damaging to Republicans, but they're still getting blamed more than Democrats. And when you factor in all the good things that have happened with Trump, particularly in the Middle East over the past couple of weeks, shouldn't it be up more than 2 points? And this is why I'm coming to a theory here, because this all relates to Obamacare and health care. At least that's what the Democrats want to say. Part of this is them just pleasing their base. They had to come out and do something. They had to fight back to show they've got the fight or whatever. But their presented reason for this fight is related to health care and what the cost is going to be on people. John Thune, Senate Majority Leader, kind of outlined what the argument from the Democrats is. And this is basically the truth of the situation. Here's John Thune.
It is truly amazing how a program Democrats created and tax credits that they chose to sunset have now become the Republicans' crisis. Republicans, in fact, never had anything to do with it. Democrats created Obamacare alone. They implemented the enhanced tax credits alone. And they chose a sunset date for those tax credits alone. Democrats are solely responsible for the Obamacare tax credit cliff. And yet they're trying to pin this disaster on Republicans while at the very same time they're asking Republicans to bail them out.
Now, he's right on every part of that, but the part I want to focus on most is they chose a sunset date for those tax credits alone. They did, right? And you don't remember how this worked. Obamacare was passed back in 2009, 2010, whenever that was. It made it through. Republicans tried for a while to fight it. As we predicted at the time, they will eventually stop trying to fight it and they will embrace subsidies because this is what everyone does. So you get a program, you get free money, you want that free money to continue. Of course, we also predicted at the time that the Affordable Care Act would be anything but, and it has become anything but. In fact, we know that now because even the Democrats are saying it's unaffordable. They are saying that if we go back to Obamacare, which is basically as passed, that is the situation if we do not extend these tax credits. It will be a catastrophe and all these people will be miserable. Well, that's your plan. It's your Obamacare. You're the one that wanted that. So what they're saying is either we get all these new credits or we go back to this terrible thing that we invented. Now, what what's important to focus on with Thune's quote there is the timeline of this. Obamacare exists. It runs for a long time. COVID happens. During COVID, and this is not during Trump, this is once Biden gets in office, his first big bill includes a giant chunk of money to go to free Obamacare or discounted Obamacare. Massive subsidies going to Obamacare. The justification at the time, we're on the very tail end. In reality, we're kind of past it. In some blue states, though, you're still having some school closings and work closings and stuff like that. There was still some hesitation, you know, some closing and hesitation as far as fear goes when it comes to COVID. That stuff's going on. They put these big subsidies in for a year. And they say, okay, we're in the middle of a crisis. We need to have these for a year. Then that year comes up and it's about to go away. And the Inflation Reduction Act occurs. And Biden comes in and says, you know what? We need to extend this. I think it was four more years, ending in 2025. Again, they selected the dates, these tax credits go away, knowing, hey, where are we going to be in late 2025 going into early 2026? We're going to be going into a midterm election where we might not be in power. We need to have something to be able to fight with Republicans on. We need to be able to things to accuse them of. So they knew this would go away. Either they're in power and they can continue them, or they're not in power and they can use them as a cudgel against Republicans. That's, of course, what they're doing right now. They're in the middle of doing this. Now, they know this because they know how important healthcare costs are. They're very, very high on people's mind. Here's a poll from AP. Top of the mind, what is the most extremely and very important issue? Number one is the economy. Number two is healthcare. 84% said the economy. 81% said healthcare. 72% crime. 58% immigration. 57% gun policy. Abortion, 49%. Climate change, 42%. Transgender issues, way, 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 way down. Half of everything else, just to kind of put that on your radar, only 20% said that mattered to them. So this is what Obamacare is. These subsidies are just this thing we kind of stapled onto Obamacare to say, hey, we're so sorry about how Obamacare was turning out. You should have extra subsidies stapled on under the auspices of COVID. Tim Carney wrote about this. Insurance subsidies are a costly fix to Obamacare's leaky ship. During the 2020 election, Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden proposed a fix, increasing subsidies for everyone below 400% of the poverty line. Are you freaking kidding me? And extending the subsidies to wealthier customers so as to get rid of that tax credit cliff. Pandemic provided an excuse for this effort to save Obamacare's exchanges, and Biden's American Rescue Plan established these extra subsidies as temporary. But as the crisis requiring this fix, the death spirals in the exchange, the general ballooning of healthcare spending was not temporary. This was always supposed to be a permanent fix to Obama's leaky 2010 healthcare law. More on that in a moment. When the prime time came for Democrats to make the extra subsidies permanent, they faced an obstacle, Joe Manchin. The misnamed Inflation Reduction Act was the Democrats' vehicle for extending these subsidies, but West Virginia Senator balked at the price tag. Democrats had to make the bill less expensive to get his vote, so they reduced the 10-year price tag by extending the subsidies only till the end of 2025. Here we are in 2025, Democrats figuring they can use the prospect of skyrocketing middle-class and working-class healthcare premiums as a cudgel in which to attack Republicans. Exactly what we were just talking about. In this fight, Democrats have had a quiet ally, the health insurance companies. The extra subsidies are not tax credits to insurance customers, but transfers from the Treasury to private insurance companies. Wonder why that didn't work out. These subsidies have given the insurers more customers, driving up enrollment, and also made customers less price sensitive because Uncle Sam was picking up part of the tab. I've never understood the argument that this is going to be bad for insurance companies. You know, millionaires and billionaires, the tax companies are going to, these insurance companies are going to, you know, hate Obama. Why would they hate Obamacare? You're legally requiring them to be customers. I would love that. If I was like running a McDonald's and we passed the required Big Mac lunch once a week bill, you'd be kind of thrilled if you were McDonald's, right? I mean, we're going to sell a certain amount of Big Macs no matter what. That's what happened with Obamacare. Now, the question here, not they set this timeline up where they know they can beat Republicans with these raising rates that are their creation. What do Republicans do? What do Republicans do? Marjorie Taylor Greene sounds alarm over expiring health care subsidies as shutdown continues. Marjorie is in favor of the subsidies. She wants, now she's still complaining about Obamacare, which that's great. But she's saying, well, this is a real problem when we do have to get some money over to these people. At least that's how her argument is being presented. I'm sure there's a little more nuance to it than that. But Ro Khanna doesn't see much nuance. She says, I agree with Marjorie Taylor Greene on health care. Bipartisanship, boys and girls, always good outcomes from bipartisanship. Always remember that. Here's Ro Khanna talking about this particular issue when it comes to subsidies for health care and Marjorie Taylor Greene. And it's important to understand, listen to the way he frames this. Watch.
We cited the example they had last week where they said, even if the subsidies expire, 80% of subsidies are going to be covered, or 80% of the premiums are going to be covered by taxpayers paying these subsidies. Why is the system, when we were told it was going to really improve everything and make things more accessible, why is it in such dire financial situation that it would take 80% of it being underwritten by taxpayers for it to continue?
Because the insurance companies are ripping us off. They've had $171 billion of profits. They've got their CEOs making about $170 million. Now, I supported the Affordable Care Act, and President Obama said we can't have people having cancer not be treated. We can't have young kids not having insurance. But it was a humanitarian fix. It wasn't a fix to the system. Oh. The fix to the system is to get rid of these private insurance companies that are hurting our companies, hurting our manufacturers, and fleecing the American public, and have everyone have Medicare for all, and then you can have supplemental private insurance. That is the fix to the soaring costs.
Oh, I see. So Obamacare wasn't about solving the problems of the healthcare system. It was about a humanitarian fix until we got to the main solution, of course, which is Medicare for all. You'll also know that as a single payer program. Where have I heard this before? Where have I heard this before? I know, you know, I've said it a bunch of times. Glenn Beck has said it a bunch of times. Lots of conservatives have pointed out this could be an issue. But I remember this specific approach to Obamacare turning into a single payer program. Where did I hear that? Here's a clip from 2008 at the Tides Foundation.
Someone once said to me, this is a Trojan horse for a single payer. And I said, well, it's not a Trojan horse, right? It's just right there. I'm telling you. We're going to get there. Over time, slowly, but we'll move away from reliance on employment-based health insurance, as we should, but we'll do it in a way that we're not going to frighten people into thinking they're going to lose their private insurance. We're going to give them a choice of public and private insurance when they're in the pool, and we're going to let them keep their private employment-based insurance if their employer continues to provide it.
It's not a Trojan horse. It's just right there. I'm telling you this is what we're doing. And of course, this is what they were doing, and it's what they're in the middle of accomplishing if Republicans don't come up with a backbone. And here's the problem. We're seeing some Republicans flake off already. So what's the strategy here? Why haven't we heard all of this coverage? Quickly, I'll give you an outline of this. Democrats are, I think, keenly aware of this date. They know this date is coming. They know when people go to sign up for their Obamacare that they're now dependent on, they're going to see the rates a lot higher than they were last year. They're going to go back to the rates that they had in 2018 and 2019 when it comes to a percentage. Those numbers are going to be a lot higher now. That is going to create a backlash, and it's going to create pressure. Democrats, instead of complaining about all the sob stories of the people being laid off this time when there's a shutdown, instead have just been talking about health care. They want to be known to everyone as the one trying to fix your health care problem. Well, what happens when these rates go up? What they're betting on is that Republicans will fold. Why? Because they usually do. Because they usually do. They've already folded on even attempting to get rid of Obamacare. That November 1st deadline is, what, 11 days away? When that deadline, and I don't, deadline's the wrong word for it, the beginning date of signing up for Obamacare, this is when they're first going to see these rates, and they're going to get slapped in the face with them. Democrats have been waiting, I think, for this the entire time, and they're waiting patiently for this to kick in because they know they have some leverage coming. And people like Marjorie Taylor Greene, at least give them credit for the knowing the politics of the situation, know this is going to look bad for Republicans. They're going to start getting blamed. They're going to go down the wrong road, which is going to and is already creating a situation that Republicans may very well fold. I don't, you know, Trump, when he believes in something, he doesn't fold. Like, you know, he really believes in something, he doesn't fold. But I don't think this is central to his ideology, health care subsidies. I mean, he's not a big, he doesn't care about spending like maybe you or I do. That's just not his approach to things. He'd rather try to grow his way out of the problems. I don't think that's, you know, possible here for a bunch of different reasons we don't need to get into. But I don't think he's going to just like necessarily fold. I think you will see some folding going on the Republican side. And this is what the Democrats are going after. So it's important for us to kind of get out in front of this and say, hey, we know this is coming. We know this November 1st date is coming. Time to wake up and make sure that we do not fold on this issue because it's way too important. Every once in a while, something reminds you how fragile life can be. You take something like a power outage that lasts longer than expected, or maybe a storm that shuts down the roads for a few hours, or maybe even days. And a new headline kind of comes up and says, wow, how prepared am I? That's when it hits you. Our entire healthcare system runs on the assumption that everything will keep working. We've been talking today about how Obamacare has basically stopped working. Pharmacies, we think, are going to stay open. Trucks will keep delivering whatever, no matter what, right? That's always going to be the case. Well, not really, as we're seeing over and over again. That's where Jace Medical comes in. They made it simple to get a year's supply of your prescription medications. You take a pill every morning or most mornings, and you have that thing where, like, gosh, I wish I could just have this for a long period of time. Well, Jace can help you with this. Instead of having to go back to the pharmacy over and over and over again, you don't want to be dependent on the system when it fails. And they have licensed physicians that will review your needs. They have a pharmacy that will ship directly to you. And everything arrives discreetly at your door. Get a nice big supply of this stuff. You know you're going to be taking it anyway. Peace of mind, you know, look, isn't something that you can just buy at a drugstore. But you can get it through Jace Medical. Because when things get uncertain, having the medicine that you need shouldn't rely on the government. Jace.com is the place to go. Jace.com. The promo code is Stu. Check out the discount on the order that they've got going on right now. It's Jace.com, J-A-S-E.com, J-A-S-E.com. The code is Stu.
Einsteigen, aufdrehen, losfahren. Mit dem neuen Volkswagen T-Roc bist du bereit für den großen Auftritt. Selbstbewusst und voller Power. Du steigst ein? Keine Kompromisse. Nur du und der Moment. Alles passt. Dein Sound, dein Drive, dein T-Roc. Rockt. Der neue T-Roc.
Ah, what a night. I don't even know if you can tell. My voice is shot. today. It's been really hard to get through. I did this show previous to this. I did an appearance on the Megyn Kelly show today. Previous to that, the radio show. So my voice is, this is already a tough day on my voice when I have to do all these shows together. And then add on to the fact that I was screaming like a lunatic last night as George Springer hit a 3-run home run in the 7th inning for the Toronto Blue Jays to be victorious, a 4-3 victory in Game 7 of the ALCS. And, you know, I'm somewhat maniacal Blue Jays fan. So I, you know, this comes from my childhood. I was on a little league team called the Blue Jays, and it became my favorite team. So it's me, my daughter, my son, my wife. I guess she would call herself a Blue Jays fan, though she doesn't really care about baseball. But the bottom line is the families are Blue Jays fans. It's bizarre because we love America. I actually have a Blue Jays shirt with an American flag on it. Doesn't make any sense at all. But I'm America's only Blue Jays fan. And you have to make sure you understand how excited I am for this. And I always say they're America's team. And I say that partially America's team for a couple of reasons. One, to annoy Cowboys fans. That's always the priority. Two, because there's not really a lot of hatred towards the Toronto Blue Jays. Most people barely even know they exist, even if they follow them baseball on a day-to-day basis. They're kind of like this team that there's not like a rivalry, right? Like it's not like Cubs and White Sox or Mets and Yankees, and they want to hate. No one really hates the Blue Jays because they're just the Blue Jays. They're up there in Canada and they show up every once in a while to play. However, right now they kind of are America's team, and the reason I say that is because they're going up against the Dodgers. And I will say anyone who has followed baseball lately is pretty kind of annoyed with the way the Dodgers approach things and that they do everything very much within the rules, but do spend more than everybody else and get lots and lots of players and have seemingly an all-star team and then just swept the Brewers in the NLCS. So we will, I think this is one of those times, the Blue Jays previously played the Yankees and the same thing happened, where there was a bit of uniting around America's team, the Toronto Blue Jays. So we will continue to follow this closely for you. I will say, you know, look, there's a lot of stories we're talked about, important ones, healthcare. We're going to come up with some, we're going to talk about the Democratic violence problem coming up again. We're going to talk about maybe a little Israel by the end. The one story I actually care about is the Toronto Blue Jays. It was freaking exciting. I love this team. I just love these guys. I had no expectations coming into this season that this would actually happen. So this is all gravy. Very excited, very terrified of the Dodgers, but that's a whole different story. We'll worry about that on Friday. But for now, congratulations to America's team, the Toronto Blue Jays. So I was talking to my producer, I don't know, a couple of weeks ago after the Charlie Kirk thing, and I was reading all the stories about how actually all the violence out there has been right-wing violence until this one incident, and this is just one thing, and maybe that one might even be right-wing itself. And I thought, am I living in an alternate universe, alternate dimension? Like, what am I missing here? And I thought to myself, we need to do a monologue or something and just break down all these studies that keep claiming it's right-wing violence instead of left-wing violence that we're seeing all the time. And as I began doing that, I was reading through the Federalist, and I said, well, Bruce Gilley's already done that, so let's just bring on Bruce Gilley. He's a professor at Portland State University, author of The Case for Colonialism. He has a new piece at the Federalist right now. Data doesn't lie. Political violence is an overwhelmingly left-wing problem. Bruce, thanks so much for coming on the program. Thanks for doing this work.
Thanks for having me here today.
You saved our producers quite a lot of time. I would like to kind of go through what made you go into this, because what I keep reading in publication after publication after publication is there's all these studies, these databases that are keeping track of political violence, and they show overwhelmingly it's right-wing violence. One of them, I think, said just recently it's switched to left-wing violence just this year, but overwhelmingly it's been right-wing violence for a very long time. You looked at the data. What did you find?
The data is essentially fabricated, and that's, I think, a charitable interpretation of it. And what's been happening is, in part, I think, because people are cowed with the idea of data and nobody has the time to look into it, that a whole bunch of research projects have been developed in the last, let's say, 10 years. Cato has one, various universities have ones, you have research projects running, used to be in coordination with the Department of Justice. And essentially the way these research projects work is something bad happens. The researchers, first of all, decide if it's clearly left-wing, in which case they'll ignore it. And if there's any way to link it to the right, like the person may have, you know, lived in Montana, even though they're running around with Antifa T-shirts on, then they'll code it as right wing violence. And this data is such poor quality that it only takes an educated person to start looking at the cases and how they've classified them to immediately realize that this idea of this vast wave of right wing violence is a fabrication. And it's not just, I think, you know, honest mistakes. I honestly think these are quite dishonest mistakes. I think it's quite intentional attempts to both cover up the pervasiveness of left-wing violence in our country, as well as to create this mythology of this, you know, vast set of right-wing white supremacists, militiamen, you know, incelebs, I mean, every sort of idea you can think of to distort the truth.
Yeah, it's funny because, first of all, I completely reject the idea that white supremacy is a right-wing phenomenon. It has nothing to do with it's identity politics, and I don't think it's right-wing at all. But that's besides the point. You know, you point out that some of the people putting this data together, you know, there's a, like, seeming like an Antifa activist, at the very least a very crazy left-wing activist who's running one of these things. You know, the motivation there seems to be pretty clear.
Yeah, so the activists, and there's one at SUNY in New York, and there's one at the University of Cincinnati, and these are people like off the deep end left wing, who view all forms of left wing violence not really as violence, but as acts of justice and community healing. Whereas anytime someone, you know, beats up a homeless person, they'll say, oh, that's right wing violence. You know, it may be another homeless person beating up the homeless person, or it may be it may be a left-wing person trying to get the homeless person out of their way. But if a homeless person gets beat up, it's automatically classified as right-wing violence because, of course, we all know that conservatives have it out for the homeless. So this is basically how these projects work. And maybe those ones are less surprising because we can dismiss them given the poor credentials of the authors. But I think the ones by Cato and others that are done by Center for Strategic International Security, which are supposedly, you know, authoritative think tanks, prove to be just as bad.
Well, it's interesting. Like Cato, for example, is a good example. We have people from Cato on the show, some of the people over at Cato. I think they do some really good work. Why are they wrong on this? They don't have a motivation, I don't think, to just vilify the right an Antifa activist would. Why is their data incorrect?
It's mainly just they code things wrongly. For instance, the man who shot up an Asian massage parlor last year and killed three or four of the staff, who had obviously become addicted to prostitution and was, you know, angry about his prostitution addiction, went up and shot up the brothel. Well, they classified that as right-wing violence. Why? Because the victims were not white. Therefore, anytime a white man commits violence against a non-white person, it's considered right-wing violence. Now, you go figure that out. And that's what I call the racial violence loophole that they use to slip through any and all manner of crime involving a white on one side and a non-white on the other. All get swept into the right-wing basket, no matter whether there's any stated motivations that are racist, whether the person who's racist is even a right-wing racist or a left-wing racist, of which there are just as many. So there's just these untested assumptions that are sneaking into the data, even for a group like Cato, that are just never challenged. And when The Economist ran an article on these supposed databases after the Charlie Kirk murder, you know, they even kind of anticipated this criticism. They said, well, there'll be conservative skeptics who question the data because of the people running it. And it's almost as if they recognize that the moment someone lifts the carpet on this stuff, they're going to realize how bad this data is.
Mm. I will point out again, racism is collectivism. So that is not a right-wing principle. I don't understand. We are individualists, if anything else. I don't understand that. But to move on behind this, you talk about a couple pieces of sleight of hand that they do in these. There's a lot of since 9/11 is a big one they use. And also a lot of things, they'll go, if they decide to go back in history a ways, they will say since like 1975, after massive periods of left-wing violence. It just seems like on the surface here, there's a lot of stuff that we've seen. And the average person would look at this and say, hey, you know, what about the George Floyd riots? What about, you know, all of these other large scale violent outbreaks? They were left wing. That's not how the data sees those movements, does it?
Yes, that's right. So it's kind of the elephant in the room, and it's kind of like this doesn't pass the laugh test. So if you take the BLM riots and the violence and the number of policemen murdered in cold blood by BLM activists, none of which, by the way, show up in these databases because they'll say, well, the motivations were not clear, or, you know, this was part of a social justice movement and therefore it cannot be ever classified as political violence. But, you know, none of those cold-blooded hits on cops that happened during BLM make it into the databases, nor the fact do any of the rioting, the destruction of property, the injuries caused during BLM show up. None of that's in there, right? Also not in there, in terms of left-right, is all the Islamic terrorism, which is by far 80 to 90% of political deaths in the United States are caused by Islamicists, not just 9/11, but, you know, the San Bernardino shooting, the nightclub in Orlando. I mean, on and on and on. These are mass killing incidents, which by far outstrip any other sort. What these databases do is they say, well, we're just going to call this Islamic violence. It's not really easy to classify it as left or right. Now, you could say that. On the other hand, as I say, the Islamicists get far more comfort on the left than they do from the right. I've never been to a conservative gathering where people chant death to America or from the river to the sea. But nonetheless, once you eliminate that, you're sort of eliminating what is nonetheless the central challenge for the United States in terms of political violence, which is Islamic terrorism. So for Joe Biden as president to say that the number one threat to the United States in terms of domestic terrorism is white supremacy was either just clueless, like Joe forgot about 9/11, or quite intentionally treasonous in terms of ignoring the major threat to the U.S. homeland.
That's an unbelievable omission, right? Like all the most serious incidents that you can remember. Let's just eliminate all of those and then focus on what's left. Take me to one particular case, which is the case of the state representative in Minnesota that was killed. This is one that was brought up a lot after the Charlie Kirk thing, because they would say, hey, well, you didn't say anything about that particular case. It was the person who carried out those murders, were they politically motivated, and were they conservative?
I don't think either is true. Now, they, on the one hand, had been appointed to some consultancy board or advisory board by Governor Waltz. He seemed to be moving around on the fringes of Democratic politics in the state. On the other hand, he had a bunch of No Kings flyers in his car. Was that because he was going to join it, or because he was going to attack it, or because maybe he wasn't sure because he's just a mentally unstable person? But you can't take the paucity of evidence on the motivations of that person and immediately declare it to be right-wing or Republican violence. On the other hand, ignore the overwhelming evidence when someone with a BLM t-shirt goes and murders a cop in cold blood and then say, well, the motivations are uncertain because, you know, they didn't actually state in a written statement ahead of time that they hated the cops and they're doing this for BLM, right? So you get this essentially this asymmetry in the rush to judgment against anything that sniffs of the right, and absolutely no rush to judgment in anything that sniffs of the left.
How much do you chalk this up to? Because I agree with you on your analysis of this. I mean, I think it's quite clear. You lay it out in very obvious terms and very specific terms throughout your piece. It's a lengthy piece. It's worth your time to read. But how much of this do you think, and the continuation of the left-wing violence, goes to incentives? And the way I think about this is, you know, if there was a person who shot someone at an abortion clinic or something, that person would not be at all celebrated by the right. That person would be vilified by the right. I would say that they're doing incredible damage to the pro-life cause for it. We would blast them on the air. We would say this person was nuts and crazy and don't listen to him and all these other things. That is not what happens when you have an act of left-wing violence. We see people celebrating Charlie Kirk's murder. We see what happened with the healthcare CEO being murdered in cold blood in New York City. That, you know, he's like a pinup boy on calendars now. Like, do those incentives encourage and increase the amount of violence over a long period of time?
Yes, absolutely. And it goes to the very heart of the sort of DNA of the conservative or the classical liberal view of the world versus the left-wing socialist view of the world. Generally speaking, people on the left believe political violence is justified because the world is full of oppression and the only way to achieve liberation from oppression is violence, right? That just goes back to the fundamentals of Marxism, of Leninism, of Che Guevara, of all the great anti-colonial violent madmen, Frantz Fanon, who's read in the university today. So this creates an incentive, indeed, that you may, you know, end up in jail, but you'll be a hero. Luigi Mangione being the classic example right now. On the right, by contrast, the emphasis is on ordered rule, the maintenance of institutions and traditions, change through incremental persuasive means, not through violence, right? And therefore, you're right. If someone, you know, so if someone were to have assassinated Edward Said, the famous professor from Columbia who developed much of the kind of third world, you know, anti-Americanism, and by the way, was directly responsible for Hamas's doctrine. And you might say that a supporter of Israel, just like a person who didn't like Charlie Kirk, would be just as motivated to get up on a rooftop and take him out while he was speaking. Of course, we would never condone that on the right. Nobody would ever say, that's great that Edward Said was just assassinated because I really disagreed with his views. So there's no incentive on the right to commit this kind of act. You will be vilified by the right. You will be dismissed. You will be shown as no different than the lunatics on the left. The same is not true on the left. So there is an incentive difference, and a difference of treating people who, you know, shoot up individuals, you know, buildings, institutions. And that's, so not surprisingly, the data should show left-wing violence is more prevalent. That's why this data showing, oh, it's actually the right, strikes everyone as not plausible. And then you're kind of beaten into submission by saying, well, the experts have done the data and, you know, you be quiet. You know, we have these people with advanced degrees and highly funded research projects. But, you know, scratch the surface. And I do this with my students all the time. Scratch the surface below these citations and these databases and you'll find much of it turns to mush.
Mm-hmm. If you're like me and you saw all these stories that came out and they kept saying, oh, it's all right wing violence, and you kept kind of crinkling your brow and saying, wait a minute, that doesn't seem right. You really need to read this piece. It's called Data Doesn't Lie. Political violence is an overwhelmingly left-wing problem. It's Bruce Gilley, professor at Portland State University. He's also the author of The Case for Colonialism. Be sure to check out that new piece. Bruce, really appreciate you taking the time to put all this together, saving my producer a bunch of time as well, and making sure the truth gets out there. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Enjoyed it.
Hamas, diminished but not destroyed, reasserts itself in Gaza. This, I will say, this does not seem like the actions consistent with someone, a group of people in the middle of going through a 20-step peace process in which they hand over power and all of their weapons. It does not seem the way that they're acting right now. There's been a little bit of a flare up here. Their advances over there trying to calm everything down again. My guess is eventually this is going to, you know, flake apart a little bit because there's a lot of different moving pieces. Good thing is at least the hostages are home. There is a new poll out finding soaring approval for Trump's handling of Israel-Hamas war. 47% approve, 34% disapprove. And that's made up bizarrely of a 57-19 opposition to Donald Trump on the Democratic side. Approval from Republicans and independents, but still, it's bizarre. Now, this is the entire war, not just the peace deal, so maybe that explains some of it. But bottom line is, you know, it's hard to have a better outcome, you'd think, in at least short term for Donald Trump, and still 57-19 against him on the Democratic side. The only thing that will unite people more than a peace deal, of course, the Toronto Blue Jays. Go Blue Jays, and down for the Dodgers. Please, come on.